Hello and welcome to the Institute of Economic Affairs podcast with me, Emily Carver, Media Manager at the IEA. The date is Monday, 6th of April, 2020. If you like what you hear, don't forget you can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple, Spotify and Podbean. And you can check out our most recent episodes in our extensive back catalogue or subscribe to our new IEA daily newsletter to never miss a podcast. Our ability to predict crises is severely limited. We only need to look back to the largely unforeseen global financial crisis of 2008, or look to the current pandemic sweeping the globe to see that that's the case. What we can be sure of, however, is that every so often we're going to come up against a largely unforeseen, unpleasant shock, and that when this inevitability occurs, we'll need the money and resources to overcome it once again. When the dust eventually settles and coronavirus becomes a historical consideration, policymakers will be tasked with looking at what could have been done better and what mistakes we might have avoided. But is there a way we could have planned for such a crisis? As the IEA's Director General Mark Littlewood points out in his Times column this week, there is already a tried and tested method of dealing with unknown future predicaments, namely insurance. However, to our own detriment, we've allowed our own system of national insurance to turn into merely another form of taxation. Instead of seeing contributions as an investment for future moments of need, they're used to fund everyday spending. Have our politicians forgotten the importance of saving for a rainy day? Is our national insurance system even salvageable? And what learnings should the government take after this crisis is thankfully behind us? Joining me to discuss this is Mark himself. Thank you, Mark, for coming on the podcast.
Good to be with you, Emily. Good to be with you.
You acknowledge in your article that very few of us could have foreseen this pandemic, or indeed foreseen other crises over the years that have similarly given our finances a battering. But do you think the UK could have been in a better situation to ride out the COVID-19 storm?
Well, basically, yes. What I'm taking as my starting point, and some free market liberals will disagree with this, but I'm taking as my starting point, for the sake of argument, assume what the government's doing at the moment in terms of all of the spending, colossal amounts of extra money for the NHS to deal with the crisis, underwriting virtually every job in the British economy, loans to businesses to keep them alive. I mean, an absolutely enormous amount of public expenditure. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, they've got it bang on right that we need to spend all of this money. The question is, how do you prepare yourself for these eventualities? And the truth of the matter is, our public finances are not in a great state. Since the Conservatives came to office in 2010, they've been gnawing away at our budget deficit each year. So they've been sort of trimming it towards zero. Initially, they were going to balance the books within 5 years. That quickly became 10. We're now going to have gone 20 years without running a budget surplus. So what that means is, when a problem hits us, if you were to liken it to your own household income, if you sort of suddenly need to repair, you know, a massive hole in the roof, or your boiler blows up, or something else disastrous happens in your own household, the idea is that you have hopefully tucked away a bit of money while the times were relatively good, and you've got a savings account that can now pay for a new boiler or a hole in the roof or some other eventuality that you had not foreseen. We haven't been doing that. So all of the money being spent now is on tick. It's on credit. We've reached for the credit card. And what I was trying to get to in my article was a suggestion that national insurance in particular, and that's only one aspect of government revenue, shouldn't be run as a scheme in which people your age, Emily, are seeing that your contributions immediately go into my parents' pocket who are in their 70s. What we need to start to get towards is the idea that contributions and savings and insurance are put aside and then called upon in this sort of circumstance. Now, that's a lot easier said than done, because the country is colossally in debt to the tune of about £1 trillion, let alone all of the liabilities that we've got to meet. And that debt's going to go up. So we've already, I wouldn't say we've maxed out the credit card, but the credit card's taken one hell of a beating. And all of the money we're spending now, combined with the fact that tax revenues are obviously going to collapse in the coming months, means that the hole we're going to be in after this is even deeper. We didn't mend the roof while the sun was shining, in other words. And I appreciate it hasn't been that sunny over the past 10 or 12 years, but it has been a lot sunnier in the last 10 or 12 years than in the last 5 or 6 weeks. So I think we've got to find a much more fiscally prudent way of doing it. And my suggestion in the article in Monday's Times, in today's Times as we're recording this, was that we should at least look again at national insurance, which I think most people now just treat as a kind of another form of income tax. You know, they see their pay slip and income tax has come out and national insurance come out, and that's just sort of the money that goes to the government. And some people have even argued that for simplicity's sake, we should just sort of merge the two, that it's a bit of a con, really, to believe that your income tax is really 20% when it's more like 32% because national insurance is on top. And that national insurance, to all intents and purposes, just goes into the general pot of expenditure. What I'm suggesting when we finally get out of all of this, and even if we're willing to accept that the government's got to do a vast amount of spending at the moment to try and keep the country in something approaching one piece, is perhaps we need to learn again that there's a distinction between two types of things. There can be general government expenditure paid for out of general taxation. If you want more to be spent on the Arts Council or more computers in classrooms or whatever, sort of day-to-day consumption, well, you're going to have to raise more tax to pay for it. And separately, we should look at national insurance as being a rainy day fund, not exclusively for crises like this, I should say. I mean, crises will hit individual people even in normal times. They'll suddenly lose their job, they'll suddenly get sick, they'll suddenly need assistance. But obviously, this has been a colossal crisis where, if you like, all of us have had our boiler break down and a hole blown in the roof. And there has been no rainy day fund to deal with it. Now, governments can deal with that. They can borrow more money. That's what they're doing. But that just means the hole you're digging for yourself gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And we didn't use the time between the last crisis and this one. And let's just say, for sake of argument, there's going to be a major crisis every 12 years, 2008, 2020. You know, between 2020 and 2032, if there is a sort of 12-year cycle there or thereabouts, let's put some money aside. Let's save, rather than just spend, living from one paycheck to the next, in order that when whatever happens next, I don't know whether it be flooding, a natural disaster, a terrorist attack, another financial crisis, who knows what it will be, but we know there will be something. Let's make sure there's money tucked aside to deal with that, rather than us just reaching for the credit card next time too.
Yeah, definitely. Looking back to your article, you said that the national insurance scheme is being run like a Ponzi scheme. Do you think we're essentially being ripped off by government?
Well, it kind of depends who you are. The Ponzi scheme's named after a rather dubious businessman called Charles Ponzi, who was operated in America in the 1920s. And his wizard scam was this. To make it look like investing in the scheme was terrific, he would give huge rates of return to early investors. So they've given him a dollar, and before they know it, they're getting $2 back. The scheme looks great, so everybody then flocks to join it. In fact, he wasn't paying the early investors out of having made a successful rate of return. It wasn't that he was investing money better than the market, or all his venture capital projects were doing brilliantly. He was just paying them an enhanced rate of return by getting new investors in. Pyramid selling, it's sometimes called as well. So actually, if you were one of those early investors, it's pretty rosy. You were the first person to give Charles Ponzi money. You've got great rates of return. He goes bragging about how great the rates of return are. But ultimately, the system collapses. So at the moment, we have state pensions being a very, very large part of our overall welfare bill. We've triple locked the state pension. That means if you're getting the state pension, it will go up with inflation or 2% a year, or wage growth, whichever is the greatest of those. None of that was paid for when these people were paying their national insurance stamp. It's being paid for by you. It's not as if my parents are now getting the rate of return on their wisely invested money. They're being paid for out of your contributions. And that's a very, very dangerous way to organise things. You obviously can't segue out of it immediately. There's no way we can suddenly say to people in their 70s and 80s, sorry, the pot's run dry, you've got to go back to work. We should probably treat what we, if you like, owe people who are expecting this, we should treat that as a one-off liability. But quickly, for people my age, I'm in my 40s, or certainly your generation in their 20s, to be a bit more honest and to actually say, well, look, Emily, for every £10 you give us, I'm afraid £1 or £2 is going to have to go to Mr. and Mrs. Littlewood Senior. But the other £8 is going to be put in the Emily Carver pot for you to draw down when you need help with ill health or you're unemployed or some such like.
Yeah, there's so little understanding of this across the board, I think, intergenerationally. Of course, national insurance isn't a new concept. Could you tell us maybe why it was initially introduced and what changes we've seen over the decades?
Yeah, well, the initial concept was dreamt up. Well, probably not dreamt up, but executed, carried out by the then Liberal Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. It was introduced in 1911. And the system then was that the worker would pay in a bit. I think it was 4 pence a week. The employer would pay in a bit. I think that was 3 pence a week. And the government would pay in a bit, 2 pence a week, I think that was. Mm-hmm. And these pots would grow and grow and grow. And if you fell ill or found yourself unemployed, you then claim off that insurance. In basically in just the same way that, I don't know, direct line, organised car insurance or fire insurance. Everybody sort of pays in. You're assuming that not everybody will need it. You know, most of us are able to avoid fires in our own home or a car accident. But for those who get unlucky, there's a pot to pull out of. And you were able to pull out, I think the number was back in the day then, 7 shillings a week for 15 weeks to tide you through. So that was the initial concept, but very much run as an insurance scheme. And in fact, although there was government regulation and oversight, it was run by voluntary societies, basically. I mean, cooperatives. I mean, almost a sort of voluntary version of Direct Line or Aviva back in the day. Almost you would sort of just put your pennies in a pot. And it's known as the National Insurance Stamp because your employer would actually get stamps and they would be put on your card to show that the payment had been made. Obviously, technology is a bit more sophisticated now. So that was the system. It basically becomes fully nationalised. We get rid of all the voluntary societies and it just becomes a government machine under the Clement Attlee government of 1945. You're now paying in, the government controls all the money, the government works out how to pay that out. But what we've seen really since then is a gradual deterioration and just merging in with general funding, that we shouldn't be under any illusion that this money is carefully put aside for a rainy day. It's basically just tax. And when people get sick or old or unemployed, then the government decides what to pay out. And really, we've allowed it just to become another form of general taxation. And I think it's well worth splitting the two. General taxation should be for the general things that society needs, the defence of the realm, the court system, and you might want to add extensively to that list if you believe the state should do more, you know, the Arts Council, the road network, etc., etc. But then separate to that, I think there's a case that each individual should have their own enforced. So it's not a libertarian concept. You've got to pay it. You've got to pay your insurance in the same way. If you have a car, you have to get third party insurance on your car. So you've got to pay it. And you might have a system that for those who can't, there's a government top up. But then that's kind of your portable insurance thing. And if things were to go wrong, if you were to lose your job at the IA, I was to lose my job at the IA, then we claim on it just as we would through any other system. But we've lost sight of that. And rather than, I think, going down what some people consider the simpler route of just, let's be honest, and merge national insurance and tax together, I actually think there's a case for rediscovering what the purpose was of national insurance in the first place, if you like, forcing people to save for when times get tough and then having a pot you can draw down on.
Yeah, that makes sense. Looking back to the bigger picture, do you think that what we look for, a more prudential approach to budgeting after this crisis is over, do you think there's an appetite for that? Do you think it will be politically viable? Or is it an inevitability after a crisis like this?
Well, that's interesting. The short answer is I don't know. And I think it's extremely difficult to predict the precise state of the economy after this crisis or the precise state of politics. I think things go in all sorts of different directions. You'll find on the IA YouTube channel a series of really interesting podcasts with our head of education, Steve Davies, who actually says that there are common threads of when you come out of pandemics, some good, some bad. But look, I think there is a problem in that saving money on any given day doesn't look good on that particular day. If you want to be popular or happy now, go shopping, go spending, you know, push the boat out. Saving money now and saying, well, actually, well, there's a whole load of things we'd quite like to buy today, we're not going to, because you know, in 10, 15, 20 years time, there might be another crisis. That doesn't immediately go down well in terms of gratifying the electorate. And there's all sorts of people who want more money for their hospitals, their schools, higher welfare payments, you know, and better road network, all sorts of demands. And so there's a temptation, if you like, the easy road is for politicians to always give in to that demand, sort of spend whatever we can today, and when tomorrow comes around, let's worry about tomorrow. But I do wonder, actually, whether when we come out of this, I mean, the cupboard's going to be pretty bare in terms of the government's ability to spend money. All of the painful inch by inch agonising work to try and get us to a balanced budget over the last 10 years, well, that's now for nothing. I mean, the budget deficit this year is, I think, almost certainly going to dwarf the budget deficit in 2008 when the global financial crash happened, because huge amounts of money is being spent out and tax revenues are going to fall. We don't yet know the scale of it, but it's going to be into hundreds of billions, just the deficit for this year. So the national debt goes up and you just become weaker each time a crisis comes around. I'm not saying that the British economy is going to completely fall over, but the cupboard's going to be bare in terms of the government's ability to continue to borrow money. Every pound that you put on your credit card makes it more expensive and harder to put yet another pound on your credit card. So I would hope that we get into a routine. It's difficult to make this stick by law. It needs to be discipline and kind of, if you like, political commitment. It's very difficult to devise a constitution around it, in which we say we've got to run surpluses. That's got to be the norm. In a normal year, if nothing's gone wrong, we haven't gone to war, we haven't shut down the entire economy because of a pandemic, the banks haven't collapsed, in a normal year, let's run a surplus, because we know once in a while there's going to be a rotten year and we're going to have to run big deficits. But what we've got into is, in good years, we run small deficits, and in bad years, we run colossal deficits. And that eventually is unsustainable. I'm not saying that things will collapse of the year, but it puts you in a weaker and weaker and weaker position with each successive crisis. So it's got to be surpluses. And there's a number of ways you can do that. You can be more prudential on spending, or you can try and devise better ways of raising taxes. You know, I mean, I'm not making any judgment about whether spending goes down or taxes go up, but the books have got to more than balance. Now, I'm going to make a confession here, however. There is a difference between the government's balance sheet and our personal household balance sheet. And the reason for that is you expect an individual person over their lifetime to sort of have a bell-shaped curve of really income. You know, you don't earn very much when you're a kid, if anything at all. In the early parts of your career, you're probably in debt and paying off university fees, but then your career improves and improves and improves. You probably peak somewhere in your 50s, but then you retire and you're living off what you've built up, but your ability to earn money goes and goes down and down and down until you shuffle off this mortal coil. Governments can bank, you might think, on permanent economic growth, that if you like, each year, all in all, the country will be better off. None of us can bank on that in our careers. We know at some point they're going to peak and then tail off. But the government seems to always bank on more economic growth than happens. And economic growth has been very sluggish. And I don't know what's going to be wiped off economic growth this year, but some colossal proportion of GDP, I mean, 10% or higher, I would guess. The data isn't in. But if you really do believe, if you know that the British economy is going to grow at, say, 2% every year ad infinitum, well, then you can be a bit more loose, in the same way that if you knew, Emily, that your salary was going to go up 2% a year every year between now and the day you died, you probably wouldn't worry too much about your credit card today, because you know you're going to get richer and richer and richer. So there is a difference. But governments always seem to be too optimistic. They always seem to think that growth is always the sort of permanently going to be with us. Next year will be better than this year. And generally over the long run, that's true. But you suddenly get these, you know, these downward shifts, and we need to be better prepared for them, in my view.
One of our economists, I'm not sure if you read the article, Professor Philip Booth, he wrote about how government spending during the crisis will incur costs that can't just simply be brushed under the carpet. Do you think that the government is being honest about those trade-offs that we face in the years to come?
Well, I think the problem is they don't really know what the trade-offs are.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, the nature of when you get into a crisis and you're suddenly having to do things. And I've got a lot of sympathy with the government. I mean, look, I'm a kind of low tax, low spend kind of fiscal hawk, but I'm completely identify with the position the government find themselves in. But if you do nothing, sort of you know, virtually every British company will go to the wall because we've locked down the economy. So we've got to sort of underwrite wages, offer businesses loans. They're trying to make sure that there aren't suddenly vast numbers of impoverished workers because they've all been laid off. They're trying to make sure that businesses which are otherwise robust have some sort of bridge to get them through the whatever it's going to be, 2, 3, or 4 months and out the other side. But I think they don't yet know the cost of this. They don't yet know how many staff are going to be furloughed. That's a guess. I mean, is it going to be 10% of the workforce, 20% of the workforce, 99% of the workforce? You're having to guess at that. And the bill to the government goes up and up and up. In terms of lending money to businesses to help them with any cash flow difficulties, again, how many businesses are going to take advantage of it? And how many of them are going to be able to pay back those loans, or how many will default? These are all, you know, these are all really guesses. I mean, what we can say for sure was that Rishi Sunak's first budget, which, you know, feels like it was about a century ago rather than a few weeks ago, that's for the birds. I mean, we are now opening the spending gates to the tune of, you know, tens upon tens of billions of pounds. It's difficult to be, I don't think it's so much the government's being dishonest, it's just difficult to be accurate about what the overall cost of this is going to be. But somewhere down the road, it's going to have to be paid back. Can't be paid back in one lump sum. We're going to have to spread the cost of paying it back over many, many years. Again, not dissimilar to somebody who runs up a huge credit card bill well in excess of their ability to pay. You've got to pay it back sort of in installments in a rather painful fashion. That's going to come. I mean, there isn't ultimately a magic money tree. So I think the government's going to, you know, taxes are going to have to go up. General consumption spending is going to have to go down in order to pay this back, because we've been on a splurge, actually, despite all of this sort of austerity being apparently what we've been subjected to over the past 10 years. We have in every year spent more money than we've brought in. That is not austerity. Austerity is when you spend less than you bring in. So proper austerity, I think, would be a sensible way to behave in normal, good, benign times. But we haven't. We've been on a splurge. We haven't had austerity at all.
It seems to me that there are lots of commentators on both the left and also disconcertingly on the right as well, that seem to be thinking that running budget surpluses isn't really a priority anymore, that their view that we can continue to borrow in perpetuity has been sort of vindicated by this crisis and the government's reaction. Do you think that economic liberals like yourself and the rest of us at the IEA who've been making the case for sound finances over the years, have we sort of lost the argument here? What's going on there, do you think?
Well, I don't think we have lost the argument. I mean, other than in this particular period of time, but the very nature of a crisis is it's not sustainable. I mean, you know, imagine a ghastly world where this goes on not for a few more weeks or a couple more months, but for 5 more years. The government simply can't underwrite everybody's salary in the private sector. What's happening now is extraordinary and remarkable and not sustainable. It cannot go on forever. It's going to be colossally expensive for it to carry on, even until, say, the end of May. So in the same way, I mean, if you were to treat it economically, this is a bit like us being at war. Clearly, you know, when you're trying to overcome something that presents a colossal risk to the nation, if this is indeed what it presents, similar to World War II, you don't sort of think while you're trying to defeat Hitler's Germany, you know, I wonder if we can borrow another £100,000 or so in order to properly equip the tanks. You know, you throw everything, beating the immediate threat and the problem, and worry about the impact and the legacy afterwards. You know you're going to be in a bad state afterwards because you would have spent colossal amounts of money. In the case of war, of course, there's structural devastation. There'll be less structural devastation, thankfully, owing to a pandemic, but there'll be human devastation. So you just throw everything, you throw all the mud you can at the wall and hope that you kind of get through. And, you know, I don't think that any politician at the moment would be particularly thinking through, oh, well, perhaps we shouldn't spend as much on ventilators because that's going to add, you know, a few million to the national debt in 2 years' time. They're going to throw everything they can at it. So I'm really measuring what happens when we need to sort of pick ourselves up, dust ourselves down at the end of this process. By all means, throw everything that you need to throw at it to keep the economy in something approaching one piece. But the idea that this can be the normal way of behaving, I mean, that is an absolute fiction and a fantasy. In the same way that, you know, if World War II had gone on for 25 years rather than six, you know, eventually we would have run out of room. So governments cannot behave like this in anything approaching normal times. This has to be short-term and extraordinary. And look, I don't think there's going to be many people out there. There might be a few oddballs, but there's not going to be many people out there who are saying, and what a great time it was to be alive in the spring of 2020. Those were the days. That was, you know, great sort of blitz spirit. Wasn't it marvellous? I mean, this isn't a particularly pleasant time to be
apart
alive.
From the environmentalists, of course.
Well, but I mean, perhaps that is. I mean, certainly our carbon footprint would have gone down. There's no doubt about that. But the, you know, I think most people are looking forward to having the opportunity to return to normal life, to actually see their family, to go to the cinema, to go to a restaurant, to go down the pub, to go to a bookshop. And all of that has been, you know, to go on a holiday. All of that has been completely locked down. So look, to your question, in the immediate short-term emergency circumstances for the next weeks and some, yeah, okay, of course, people are not going to be thinking particularly about how we service the debt in 10 years' time. But once we return to normal, and you know, that's not going to be that far off, I hope, you know, that's going to be a matter of weeks or months, then we really do need to have a long, hard look at this. And we're going to have to work out how we pick up the pieces, what we do to make sure that the bounce back in the economy is rapid rather than slow. I mean, a real problem after the 2008 crash wasn't just the scale of the crash, it was the ponderous growth rates to return to normal. You know, how do we get a kind of swoosh right back up? How do we really try and recover this damage quick? And none of that's going to involve the government spending money it doesn't have or underwriting every business in the country. It can't.
Yeah, well, on that note, I'd like to thank you for coming on the podcast today. That was a really, really interesting conversation. If you'd like to read Mark's Times column in full, you can find it on the IEA website, where you can also find all our latest content relating to the coronavirus and national insurance, including blogs, articles and videos, as well as all our reports and publications. And don't forget to subscribe to the IEA podcast on Spotify, iTunes and Podbean, so you can listen back to our extensive catalogue of interviews and debates.